This is Only a Game. I'm Mitch Wertlieb, filling in for the vacationing Bill Littlefield. The fate of New York City's bid for the 2012 Summer Olympics is now in the hands of the IOC Selection Committee. For 4 days earlier this week, the 13-person delegation was treated to the best the Big Apple has to offer, including a lavish evening of Wynton Marsalis, fireworks, and a star-studded dinner at the home of New York mayor-slash-multi-billionaire Michael Bloomberg. But will that be enough to overcome the allure of tea and crumpets with the Queen? New York Daily News columnist Philip Bondi has been following New York's Olympic dreams, and he joins me on the line. Philip, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Well, tea and crumpets aside, New York's most formidable opponent seems to be Paris, which has been passed over twice for, as you've put it, the honor of hemorrhaging money as host of the Games. Have Bloomberg and other supporters been able to create the illusion that this bid has any chance?
I think they have among themselves. They're pretty delusionary about that. I think it's going to be extremely, extremely difficult, in part because you have to be rebuffed once or twice by the mighty IOC, I think, before they really consider you. I mean, Paris was rebuffed a couple times, and Beijing had been rebuffed. And, you know, you have to pay your dues a little bit. And New York is a first-time rookie coming in here, and we have to be slapped down a bit.
Well, if this bid is such a long shot, why is the city trying so hard?
Well, it's tied in, of course, to the West Side development. This is what the mayor wants desperately and what the deputy mayor, Dan Doktoroff, wants desperately, is this oversized convention center slash football stadium, Jet Stadium, that they envision will create this enormous trickle-down economic effect, and everybody will be better off for it here. They're going to put it on the rail yards, and we'll all love this enormous, enormous white elephant that they want to build for us here.
Bloomberg has promised that, quote, there will be a shovel in the ground at the stadium site by the time the IOC makes its decision in early July. I wonder if the mayor has read the papers lately. He's got to be aware that the Jets' bid on the stadium site is as much as $400, $500, maybe $600 million short.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of barriers here that he's facing, and June 6th is the day that this evaluation commission that was just in New York City is going to give their little report to the IOC. Then the IOC will decide on July 6th. But it's beginning to look as if June 6th is the deadline for him, for the mayor, to show, to demonstrate that this project is going to be ready for the Olympics and that it has started. And yes, there is a ton of stuff in his way right now, including that bid, a $700 million bid for the same property that the Jets are only willing to pay $100 million or perhaps $200 million for. That's just for starters. I mean, there's also a couple of politicians in Albany who have said that they will vote against this unless they receive assurances that the New York City will, in fact, get the Olympics in 2012. So it's a catch-22 all around. You know, one side is saying, build us a stadium or else you can't get the Olympics, and the other side is saying, give us the Olympics or you're not getting a stadium, and that's where it really stands right now.
Philip, you wrote about an Olympic pep rally which you attended, at which dozens of tourists, at least, who were there, professed their support for New York's Olympic bid. But what do New Yorkers, real New Yorkers, think of the proposition?
Well, I don't think they think very much one way or the other about it. It's not part of the dialogue here in New York. I don't think very many people were even aware that the IOC commission was here, despite the fireworks. I suspect they thought something else was going on. Perhaps Derek Jeter had walked into the park or something. No, there's not much thought at all. Whereas tourists who happen to come upon this little celebration, this little pep rally, they were all for it. I mean, who wouldn't want a fun tourist attraction, sports world, the ultimate sports world, the Olympics, to come and visit? They don't have to pay the bills. They don't have to live through the construction. I mean, Athens is still facing an $11 billion deficit right now, and the city is threatening to guarantee those overruns if they happen. That's another issue that we're looking at right now.
Philip, keeping with the politics theme, it occurs to me that Mayor Bloomberg has a lot riding on this bid. He's up for re-election in November. Will all of this IOC and stadium hoopla affect his chances at re-election?
I would think so, although he has so much money, his own money, that he can pour into his own re-election that he may well come out on top anyway. But it's as close as New York taxpayers are going to get to voting on whether they want the Olympics or not, and whether they wanted the stadium or not. There is no referendum. There never is in these cities. I mean, Paris, London, there never is a referendum asking the people, do you want to host the Olympics? Do you want to spend X amount of dollars on a stadium here or there? So the closest thing that New Yorkers are going to get to that sort of a vote is going to be the mayoral election in November.
If you were a betting man, Philip, which city do you think is going to come away with the 2012 Summer Olympics?
Well, I think Paris. I mean, they have a stadium, which incidentally is not built along the Seine. It's not elbowing out the Notre Dame or the Musée d'Orsay. You know, it's a 20-minute train ride north of the city. So I think Paris is going to do just fine on this go-round. And then what is going to be interesting is to see whether New York City can reformulate its bid for 2016, because if it does, I think it does. It will be the favorite for 2016, if only by continental rotation. I mean, the other top contenders are all from Europe. If they lose this time, they know that they're not going to get it in 2016. And that, incidentally, is the only hope for NYC 2012. They're hoping that rather than give it to another European city, these European cities will turn on each other in the last minute and vote for New York City.
Philip Bondi is a sports columnist for the New York Daily News. He's also the author of the new book, Bleeding Pinstripes, a season with the bleacher creatures of Yankee Stadium. Philip, thanks for joining me.
I really appreciate it.
The nation's number one men's college basketball team is not from Durham, Chapel Hill, Bloomington, or Lexington. It's from Champaign. Ron Schachter reports.
The University of Illinois men's basketball team plays its home games in a round concrete and steel arena that looks like a spaceship from an early Steven Spielberg movie. But the only thing going through the stratosphere here in Champaign is the season the Illini are putting together. That includes a number one ranking, a 28-0 record, and the prospect of the school's first NCAA basketball championship. It's a run that's even surprised second-year coach Bruce Weber.
I thought we would be good. I thought we had a chance to be one of those teams that could reach the Final Four. Never, you know, in my wildest imagination did I think at this point we would be undefeated.
What's not so surprising is Illinois' presence among the nation's elite basketball teams. Over the past 5 years, only powerhouses Duke and Kansas have amassed more victories, and none has more wins at home. Last season, after slowly absorbing Weber's new system, the Illini won their first outright Big Ten championship in 52 years and made it to the Sweet 16 in the NCAA tournament, only to lose a hard-fought game to Duke. Again, Coach Weber.
They got a taste of success. They wanted more. And they worked very hard over the summer, weight training, conditioning, individual improvement. And I think that's the biggest thing when you look at our team. We have the system in place. We have veterans. But they've all made improvement, especially in their skills, passing, shooting, and, you know, just have a better feel of each other.
The down screen big. Go behind the screen, Rich. Go back screen the other big.
Weber still works the team hard and has assembled a starting lineup of three juniors and two seniors, who each average double figures in scoring. This season, four of the players have been named Big Ten Player of the Week, including junior forward James Augustine.
Last year, we went on the road and people would make a run on us. We'd kind of buckle and kind of get in certain situations and we wouldn't know what to do. I think this year we kind of just relax and go out there and play, worry about ourselves rather than other teams. I think the main part is just being more mature and being more focused.
Brett Dawson, the basketball beat reporter for Champaign's News Gazette, has covered the team for the past 4 years.
Because they're veterans, because they've played the game for so long, because they like each other so much and there's such good chemistry, these guys have really developed an understanding of the difference between a good shot and a great shot. They pass the ball, they share the ball, they don't worry about who gets the shot.
Dawson says Illinois' tournament history works to the team's advantage.
I think there's a tendency nationally to forget Illinois. They've never won a national championship. They've only been to four Final Fours. They haven't been to one since 1989, and so they don't have the cachet that North Carolina has. They aren't a team that gets talked about in the same way, and that may have driven these guys a little bit more even, because they are a competitive bunch.
But critics say that the Illini have fattened up on competition from the Big Ten, which isn't the dominating conference it once was. Junior guard D. Brown, the team's second-leading scorer, disagrees.
Big Ten is real competitive. I mean, I think we're one of the strongest conferences in the country just because we play defense in this conference. I mean, you got to work for every point. I think it's just a rough, you know, grinded out conference, and it's very underrated.
To underscore the point, Illinois took over the number one spot in national polls by routing ACC behemoth Wake Forest early in December. Should Illinois stay perfect and win the NCAA championship, they would accomplish a feat last achieved by the 1976 Indiana Hoosiers. And while some pundits have suggested that the Illini would actually benefit from a defeat before the NCAA tournament in mid-March, Coach Weber is having none of the L word.
Everyone keeps saying we should lose. Look at football. Did USC lose? You know, coaches say winning's a habit, and at the same time, losing's a habit. So why start a bad habit? I'd rather much have a good habit, and that's winning.
Illinois hosts Purdue on Tuesday and concludes its regular season a week from tomorrow in Columbus, Ohio. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter in Champaign, Illinois.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. It's 18 minutes past the hour. Last Saturday, residents of Syracuse, New York, failed to break Bismarck, North Dakota's record for simultaneous snow angel making. That record was set in North Dakota's capital 2 years ago by 1,791 chilly cherubs. This year, Syracusians could only muster 888, almost 200 more snowy seraphim than flailed in their first attempt in 2003. Undaunted event organizer David Zahner says Syracuse will grab for the Golden Halo again next year. Whether he can muster a record-breaking heavenly host has not yet been prophesied. I'm Mitch Wertlieb. Bill Littlefield is attending the MLS tryouts in Florida, hoping to land his dream job as backup goalie for Real Salt Lake. Good luck, Bill. Coming up on Only a Game, a season of farewells for a Vermont basketball icon. But first, after losing money and fans for years in Charlotte, the Hornets moved to New Orleans in 2002, hoping for a fresh start. The team made the NBA playoffs last year, but the Hornets are at the bottom of the Western Conference standings with a record of 11-43 this season. With the recent trades of its most talented and marketable players, things are going to get worse. Joining us on the line is Benjamin Hockman, who covers the Hornets for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. Benjamin, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. Tell me, what happened to this team?
Well, basically what we're dealing with is some disgruntled players and a lot of older players, and the combination was not very good. So what they decided to do was dismantle it, and the GM, Alan Bristow, a great guy, had been talking all along how he just wanted to do, he kept saying, just a few bypass procedures. So they traded a Darrell Armstrong or a David Wesley. But they held on to their key components, all-stars Baron Davis and Jamal Mashburn, but as Mashburn's been sitting out the whole year and Davis got more disgruntled, the trade deadline loomed, and he decided, let's just blow this thing up and start over. And what they did was they freed up a lot of money by trading those two guys. They have about $19 million to spend now in the offseason, and they'll surely have a top draft pick, and there's free agents to be purchased.
Well, I suppose if you want to look for a silver lining, there is some talk that Jamal Mashburn may never play again. Rodney Rogers, though, Baron Davis, I think, the biggest name. So it's safe to say that the Hornets have really given up on this season. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, it's safe to say they gave up on the season maybe a month ago. When you have a record like they have, there's not much hope. But what they're trying to do is get small victories. And what I mean by that is getting a lot of guys that will be backups next year, a lot of PT this year, and then build for the future. Because, I mean, they have the opportunity to be maybe a 6th to 8th seed in the Western Conference in the next couple of years if they make proper moves with all the money they have to spend now.
But right now, fans are staying away from the New Orleans Arena. No real surprise there. They're near the bottom of the league in attendance. Last year's playoff team, though, was a pretty poor draw as well. Is New Orleans not just a basketball town? Is it all about the Saints there?
Well, yeah. I mean, I look at Louisiana as a whole. It's football mania. And when the Hornets showed up, it was kind of like a rabbi moving into the Vatican. And, you know, they had to do what they had to do to get these people excited about the NBA. And luckily for them, the Hornets made the playoffs those first 2 years because the fans were able to see what NBA playoff excitement was all about. And they were there. They were rowdy. And they care about the Hornets, but it's not a – the fans don't bleed teal. They bleed Saints black and gold or LSU or even Tulane. It's definitely a process to get these fans to become NBA savvy.
Shouldn't there be some history for that because of the New Orleans Jazz?
Yeah, I think it's – we lost a generation, though, in New Orleans. In the 70s, the Jazz were pretty big in town. I mean, it was still a Saints town at the time, but they would pack the Superdome to see Pistol Pete Maravich play. But, I mean, the team left in the late 70s, and from then on, the only NBA was the bottom of the Times-Picayune sports page.
Well, at one point, the Hornets had a record of 2-29. They had a chance to become the worst team of all time. Then, of course, they rattled off 6 wins last month and ended that possibility. I wonder if it would be more fun for you to cover a team that's historically bad rather than just sort of plain bad.
I admit to everybody, I embrace this futility. It's a challenge each night when you sit down on your laptop. I mean, how can I capture this with my writing? And it's been a fun challenge, to say the least. For the most part, these are young guys who've never gotten a chance in the NBA, the Dan Dickows of the world, Chris Andersons, the Birdman, players like that, Boss John Nakbar. These guys are getting PT and a lot of opportunities. So when they lose, they're not, that necessarily the world is over because they realize they're learning and then they're building. So it's fun to watch these guys develop, even though they're getting blown out by 20 against Portland or Golden State or what have you.
How much time do you think it will take, and how long do you think fans will be willing to wait around for a kind of rebuilding process before this team gets back to playoff contention?
Yeah, that's the biggest question, and everyone seems to ask that question around town because it's true. And I mentioned earlier about going to the playoffs the first 2 years. I think that was vital for them because if they had showed up in town and not been a playoff team, and there was nothing for the fans to look forward to, and they didn't get that taste of the playoffs, I mean, we'd be in big trouble right now. I mean, the entertainment dollar in New Orleans, if you're just an average family, there's a lot to spend your entertainment dollar on. It ain't Cleveland. There's music, and there's the finest restaurants, and New Orleans is a poorer town. So this entertainment dollar, the Hornets are vying for that. And because they were able to go to the playoffs those first 2 years, I think they were able to kind of grab some of those dollars and say, hey, invest in us. We're your team. I don't know how good they'll be next year, but I think in 2 years they have the possibility, with J.R. Smith getting older, he's a rookie out of high school. He's one of the best high school players last year, and he's starting for the Hornets. If guys like that can't develop in 2 years, then we might be talking about the Kansas City Hornets.
Hmm. Well, I'll tell you one thing. I'd like to make this suggestion for a trade that could really help out the Hornets.
What do you got?
They should trade their name to the Utah Jazz. This team should be called the New Orleans Jazz.
Yeah.
I mean, is this ridiculous at this point? I mean, you've got the Utah Jazz up there, not a place known for jazz.
Yeah.
Make the trade with the team names. Let the Jazz be the Hornets. Let New Orleans get the Jazz back. I think everything turns around.
Yeah, if anything, if you're going to name the New Orleans team after a bug, I'd go with the cockroach. They run that town.
They fly down there.
Yeah.
I've seen this firsthand. I know.
No, but you're totally right. I mean, that would be a fun name to have, no question. That'd be a good trade. I'll recommend that to the general manager.
Benjamin Hockman covers the NBA for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. Benjamin, thanks again.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks a lot.
right, what we got first? Pair up. I'm paired shooting. Let's go.
This at-practice pep talk will be one of the last Tom Brennan gives as head coach of the University of Vermont men's basketball team. Brennan is calling it quits after this season, capping a 19-year career in Burlington, a school normally better known for its hockey program that produced NHL stars including Martin St. Louis and John LeClair. But in recent years, Brennan and the Catamounts have turned this northwestern corner of Vermont into a mini-basketball mecca. The Cats secured NCAA tournament berths with back-to-back America East Conference titles in 2003 and 2004 and are in prime position to make it a three-peat this year. Men's basketball has never been this popular at UVM. Home games are standing room only, and the university is already in the throes of an expansion project that may include a new sports arena. So, Tom Brennan, why leave now?
You know, my emotional bucket is emptying. I really felt that this year I'd go out with this senior class because they were so important to me personally and so important to our program. And I knew they could kind of carry me a little bit, you know, if I didn't have enough left to get to the end of the line.
It's hard to imagine Brennan needing to be carried. The 55-year-old coach seems as energetic as he was when he played college ball for the University of Georgia in the late 60s. Brennan bears a physical resemblance to hockey legend Bobby Orr. But unlike the shy, reserved former defenseman, Brennan is comfortable being the center of attention and is never at a loss for words. In addition to his coaching duties, he's the host of Vermont's most popular morning drive time radio show. He would seem a natural for a TV gig once he hangs up the coach's whistle, but he's not tipping his hand as to what will come next.
If it's going to be nothing, nobody's better prepared than me to do that. And if it's going to be something else, if the time comes, well, I'm prepared to do that as well. But I really know that I don't have the fire in my belly to coach. You know, as I said, I'm softer than Barry Manilow. I'm like their uncle now. I'm not like their coach anymore.
In fact, Brennan doesn't act much like a typical Division I head coach. Sometimes he's the one handing out towels during timeouts to the team's star forward, Taylor Coppenrath.
He is the greatest representative that we could ever have for our state university because he is a homeboy. And not only a homeboy, but a West Barnett homeboy, way out in the middle of nowhere.
With a strong low post game and surprisingly deft touch to his jump shot, the 6'9" Coppenrath looks and plays a lot like another small town forward who made a big splash in New England, Larry Bird of French Lick, Indiana. And while Coppenrath probably isn't Hall of Fame caliber, his average of more than 20 points per game this season puts him among the top five Division I scorers in the nation. And many observers, including his coach, expect he will turn pro. Along with another graduating senior point guard, T.J. Sorrentine, Coppenrath is counted on to provide the lion's share of the Catamounts' offense. The soft-spoken Coppenrath has thrived under Brennan's high-octane tutelage at UVM, but he says it wasn't always so easy for his coach.
When he came here, the teams struggled a little bit, and he always complained about nobody clapping for him when he came out, you know. But now, you know, people are up off their feet, you know, clapping and cheering for him. And I think he means a lot.
The younger players on the team may not have a sense of what Brennan had to endure during UVM's darker days. But Kyle Siplicki, a redshirt freshman guard from Shelburne, Vermont, appreciates how far the program has come.
It's easy for us young guys to figure out how special and how much all the seniors and coach mean to the community. You can just see it in the crowds and the way people talk to you around town. And we're basically living like celebrities right now, so it's been pretty cool.
The excitement that surrounds the team these days is a bit of a surprise to freshman Tim McCrory, who made a considerable leap to Vermont, all the way from Pascagoula, Mississippi.
In the South, like Mississippi State, the Hump, I went there and visited because my brother goes to school there, and it's a great college basketball atmosphere. And when I came up here, I was kind of shocked. I didn't know about Vermont fans. I thought they were going to be, like, polite, but our last few games, it's been crazy.
The standing room only crowd at Patrick Gymnasium went crazy during a recent UVM win over division rival Stony Brook. Patrick opened in 1963, and with bleacher seats that accommodate only about 3,500 people, it has the look and feel of a high school gym. Some UVM fans remember the lean years when only a couple hundred people were showing up, and Vermonters tend to appreciate folks like Brennan who are willing to stick around through tough times.
Quite a character, you know. You always see him screaming and yelling over there, trying to get the calls, you know, but it's all fun for him.
No, I think he's great. I mean, you couldn't ask for a better coach for Vermont. Taylor and TJ and all them leaving at the same time, it's going to be an end to a great career.
Well, you weren't born when I started watching him. Everybody knows Tom Brennan. and we're going to miss him. And it hasn't been easy. I mean, his program hasn't been funded like a lot of our competition, so he's been walking up the down escalator a lot of the time.
And that walk took its toll on Brennan in the early going.
It was a bad snowstorm one night, and I thought we were going to win the game, and then we just about lost it, and the other team was marching down to shoot free throws that would have won the game, and at that point, it was the most despondent that I'd been here. It was about my fourth year in, maybe, and I just thought, you know what, this ain't happening. This is not happening. Forget it. Go someplace. Try to do something else, but it's just not going to happen here. I just kept believing. I just kept believing that the day would come that has come.
Tom Brennan didn't grow up in Vermont. With his gift of gab, it doesn't surprise most people that he hails from New Jersey. But he makes his home in Burlington now and doesn't hesitate when asked what the state of Vermont has meant to his career.
Everything. I believe that I was the coach for 19 years at the university in the prettiest state in the union. I drive down 89 and I just say, you're the coach here, man. This is unbelievable. Look at what you have around you, you know. So really, to win 34% of your games for over a 15-year period and never, never once worry about being fired, that's hard to do in this day and time, especially in Division I basketball. I've been so lucky here, and I've had so many blessings here. People have taken such good care of me here. And I married up. And so if you got a rich wife, makes your decision-making much, much easier. But the reality of it is that I have everything I want. I'm at peace with myself. I'm at peace with the people around me. You got to know when to walk away. That's really an important thing. And I don't want to end up like Willie Mays with the Mets. Because it's up here now, and in order for it to stay there or even go higher, it's going to take more energy than I have.
For now, that energy is going towards making a third straight appearance in college basketball's big dance. The Catamounts will have to win next month's America East Conference playoffs to do that, and they've already sewn up home court advantage. If they do make it into the Field of 64, Tom Brennan says a win on the nation's biggest college basketball stage would be the most satisfying ending to a career he and Catamounts fans already feel is an unqualified success.
Purple dance in San Arvin. Win to touch. Get lost your feet. Have green and gold. Let's fight.
You're listening to Only a Game. Confession time. I'm one of those people who actually cares about the implosion of the National Hockey League. Wait, come back. Hear me out. If you need proof that hockey is a game worth saving, just look at this week's 25th anniversary of the U.S. Olympic hockey team's victory over the Soviet Union. Hockey can be a miraculous game. So it's been tough watching the owners, players, and league officials fall through the ice they themselves thinned. Disturbing as well is the opinion of most fans and sports writers that the players share the most burden of blame for hockey's failure to bring us a season. I'm not sure I get that. The players can't really be blamed at all, since this was a lockout by the owners. No hockey players were on strike, unlike their baseball counterparts in 1994. Now, I recognize that the players, as well as the owners, knew something had to be done because too many salaries were out of control given the sport's lack of TV revenue and mass national appeal. But who was handing out those outlandish salaries? Who decided to expand the league to places where a hockey puck is better known as a Don Rickles insult than an object for slap shots and kick saves? That would be the team owners and league officials. Sometimes you can't win for trying. The players agreed to a 24% rollback in salaries. The league scoffed. Finally, the union caved in on the one thing they said they never would, a salary cap. The numbers were less than $7 million apart, and most of us figured it was just a matter of some haggling before the Zambonis started rolling again. The fact is, once Bob Goodenow acquiesced to a cap, the fight was over. The NHL had the union on its knees with its jersey pulled over its head. There is an unwritten rule in the strange world of the hockey fight that when one player has the other in such a vulnerable position, he does the honorable thing and stops punching. But League Commissioner Gary Bettman didn't offer a compromise, and while the union didn't either, they at least agreed to the cap, which is what the NHL demanded. What's really sad is there is so much potential for hockey to be good again. Just 2 years ago, the NHL staged a wonderful outdoor contest between the Canadiens and Oilers in the frozen tundra of Alberta, and 55,000 fans braved the cold to watch what amounted to a brilliant game of pond hockey featuring some of the world's best players. Ideas like that, plus high-definition TV that could help fans see the puck better, should guide the way to an NHL that lets the players put on a show with the natural talent they possess. As stewards of the game, it's the league and its owners that bear the ultimate responsibility of making sure that show goes on. Two and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, by dairy farm families from Massachusetts and throughout New England who own Cabot Creamery, five generations making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, CabotCheese.com, and by Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting, available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, BICON.com.
I'm Mitch Wertlieb. Bill Littlefield is off this week putting the finishing touches on his 8-volume History of the WUSA. Coming up on Only a Game, Sebastian Telfair's leap from high school to the pros. But first, joining me for a look at the week's news is Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Mitch.
Hey, the NBA trade deadline came and went Wednesday. What were your favorite player swaps this week?
Well, I think Golden State is making a run to get into the playoffs for the first time in a dog's age. They picked up Baron Davis, who they will have to pay a lot of money. My favorite one, though, is the one that brought Antoine Walker back to the Celtics after Danny Ainge swore, double-kissed the pinky ring, that he would never come back again. I'm not exactly sure what the point is, except Antoine's contract runs out at the end of the year.
He is averaging 20 points a game, though, and fans liked him in Boston.
Fans liked him. The guy who runs the team didn't like him, however, and it remains to be seen whether or not the rather successful mediocrity that the Celtics have managed to stumble to in the Atlantic Division will continue.
Well, in between watching humans fly and Allen Iverson earn All-Star Game MVP honors last weekend, NBA Commissioner David Stern and Union Chief Billy Hunter expressed some optimism that a new collective bargaining agreement could be struck this summer. Now, that's a novel strategy, Charlie. Get a deal done before a lockout is imposed.
Well, I think there's no question that this particular dog and pony show was put together to show that they're not the NHL. Yeah, they will somehow manage to put together some sort of deal. The NBA has had a couple of messy things since they revived itself in the late 70s, but generally management and labor are on the same page.
Well, speaking of that league that's not really a league right now, on Tuesday, the NHL Board of Governors will meet in New York. Do you suppose the topics of discussion will be A, new high-definition telecasts once play resumes, B, replacement players, C, new rules that allow for more offense, or D, replacement players?
I think that the NHL board will get together and talk about how they're going to bring some scabs in to play something called NHL hockey next year. So a couple of whom may include Wayne Gretzky and Mario Lemieux, because they're apparently going to give the scabs a bigger ice surface on which to be incompetent. They're also going to give them high-definition TV so you can really get up close and personal with the various truck drivers, bartenders, and other accessories after the fact of consumer fraud that are going to be out there.
Yeah, when you see somebody fall down, you want to see it happen in HDTV.
Exactly,
certainly.
Right.
College hoops. Wednesday, number 24 Villanova shocked number 3 Boston College, or should anyone have been shocked at that result?
Well, Boston College had a tough game with Villanova in its own building and went down there. They've now lost 2 games this year. My guess is they'll probably lose one in the Big East tournament and drop into that semi-vast pool of teams that have between 3 and 6 losses and will be somewhere between a 2 and a 5 seed when they put the series together. It's been a terrific season for Boston College, but this was no surprise at all. Boston College was, in fact, the number 3 team in the country, was a 5-point underdog going into that game.
A little bit overrated, perhaps. Charlie, Temple University suspended head coach John Chaney yesterday for the 3 remaining games of the regular season. Now, Chaney had earlier imposed a 1-game penalty on himself, this after sending in enforcer Nehemiah Ingram against St. Joseph's on Tuesday. Ingram went ahead and broke the arm of Hawks forward John Bryant. He could be out for the year. Chaney's self-imposed penalty didn't stand, of course, but can you recall an instance in which any coach punished himself for this sort of thing?
Well, punished themselves? I don't know. I mean, it's a little bit. I mean, he got the effect that he wanted, even though they lost the game. He did put the one guy out. I would suspend John Chaney for as long as John Bryant, the St. Joseph player who he injured, was out. This was, of course, the kind of stuff that happened in the NBA all the time in the 50s.
In a similar story, assault charges have been leveled against a basketball player for Valley City State in North Dakota. This for throwing an elbow, which gave a player for the South Dakota School of Mines and Technology 14 stitches and a concussion. Now, are we seeing a trend or at least a new willingness on the part of prosecutors to bring charges against athletes for conduct on the playing field?
Well, I think you'll see them in places like Rapid City, South Dakota, where there's not a lot of spotlight. I don't think you'll see any more or less than you have in the past, no.
Charlie, Randy Moss is going to be a Raider. I guess NFL trades like this one happen, I don't know, once in a blue moon. How's he going to do in Oakland?
He'll be, if anyone was born to be a Raider, it's probably Randy Moss. He'll be fine. The problem with the Raiders, of course, is they don't have a quarterback to throw him the ball. So I think his first couple of years are going to be a problem.
So people in Oakland aren't going to care much if he pretends to take down his pants or any activity like that.
Well, they're doing it themselves in the stands, so I don't see how they could have much of a problem with him doing it.
Barry Bonds refused to address the issue of steroid use at his press conference on Tuesday. However, Charlie, he did call you, me, and everyone in the media liars. Now, does his almost biblical proclamation hold any water with you?
Well, no. He's also said it's like watching Sanford and Son, which I think is, in my case, is a compliment. He just thought he likes rerunning stories. This is old stuff. Well, it's old stuff because it hasn't been resolved yet.
Mm-hmm.
He says he doesn't know what cheating is. I have a feeling there are several grand juries that would be more than happy to inform him.
The House of Representatives is getting into this whole roid rage thing over Jose Canseco's new book. Apparently Canseco and others may be called before Congress to testify about steroids. What, aside from selling more copies of Canseco's book and the joy of seeing Canseco actually testify before Congress, will this accomplish?
This is just, I mean, we were on our way to riding every ride in McCarthy land already, and now we're actually using the original theme park in Congress. They're going to hallmark McGuire in, put him under oath. If you take the fifth, there'll be consequences, blah, 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 blah. This is something the government should stay out of. I've said that from the beginning.
Mr. NASCAR, have you been reveling in Jeff Gordon's Daytona 500 win on Sunday?
Well, I didn't pick it. I unfortunately picked Kurt Busch here on the show, and he didn't quite make it. But it was an excellent road race. And Jeff Gordon, whom 90% of the people in NASCAR hate, won it, and good for him.
Finally, Charlie, senior citizens in Klamath Falls, Oregon, they're breathing a bit easier these days after the County Board of Commissioners amended a social gaming ordinance to legalize bingo. Now, some seniors at the local senior center have been playing nickel bingo for two decades. You think this could be a national scandal in the making as well?
I don't know. I mean, the commissioner seems to have a good idea, which is to have fun with your bingo without the bureaucracy. I think everyone should have fun with their bingos without the bureaucracy.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins Bill Littlefield each week at this time for Only a Game. He's the former junior bingo champion himself of Worcester, Massachusetts. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Mitch. Bingo Masters, bright out! Bingo Masters, bright out! Bingo Masters, bright out! All he sees is a back of chairs, in the mirror a lack of hair.
A teenage basketball sensation makes the leap from high school straight to the bright lights of the NBA. Okay, you say you've heard that one before, that it's old news given the well-known stories of high school to pro stars like Kobe Bryant, Tracy McGrady, and Kevin Garnett. Well, the odyssey of Sebastian Telfair is different. A 19-year-old kid from New York's Coney Island Projects, Telfair stands at just 5'11" and is the first small player, a point guard, ever to make the risky transition from high school straight to the big time. The details of that experience are chronicled by nationally syndicated sports columnist Ian O'Connor in the new book, The Jump, Sebastian Telfair and the High-Stakes Business of High School Ball. Ian O'Connor joins me now on the line from New York. Ian O'Connor, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks, Mitch. Good to be here.
You write that Telfair started getting serious attention as a basketball phenom when he was just 10 years old. Did this kid have anything that resembled a normal childhood?
Absolutely not, Mitch. And, you know, in some ways, you probably could have written this story about a child actor in Hollywood. Sebastian Telfair is like the Macaulay Culkin of basketball. Fourth grade, he's rated the number one player in America in his class. That's a pretty sad commentary on society when we're ranking fourth graders. But he became the hope of his family. His family, generations of Telfairs, had been in the projects of Brooklyn. Sebastian had told me that he knew more friends and acquaintances who had been shot and killed than he could count. There was a lot of pressure on him from within the family to deliver his family to a better place in the world and in life. And he felt that that weighed heavily on him during his senior year at Abraham Lincoln High School.
An intriguing subplot is that he's the younger cousin by 8 years of a rather well-known New York ball player, Stephon Marbury of the New York Knicks. But the relationship between the two was a bit stormy, wasn't it?
Yes, Mitch. In fact, that was part of the pressure from within the family. Is that once Stephon Marbury made his millions in the NBA and moved his family out of the projects, the Telfairs sort of felt that, Sebastian, now you do the same for us. The Telfairs felt that the Marburys sort of abandoned them. they cut them off, that they acted like they were rich people and they weren't going to deal with projects people anymore, didn't invite them over their home anymore. So that created some tension between Stefan and Sebastian. The tension increases when Sebastian actually outplays Stefan in a couple of well-attended Coney Island pickup games. And I guess the coup de grace, as far as their relationship is concerned, came last March when Sports Illustrated asked Stefan and Sebastian to appear on the cover of their magazine together. Stefan said, basically, take a hike. I don't think my little cousin has done enough to be on the cover of Sports Illustrated. Well, as it turns out, that actually helped Sebastian because Sports Illustrated decided to put him on the cover by himself. Probably earned him a few extra million dollars in his sneaker endorsement deal with Adidas.
The sneaker endorsement deal, it's just one of the many things that Telfair had to deal with. There were feuding high school and summer camp coaches that you write about in this book, temptations from these billion-dollar sneaker companies, not to mention the pressure from his own family to land an NBA contract so he can get out of the projects. What kind of a toll did all of this take?
I think, Mitch, the one day where I really saw it take a toll on him, and he did handle it with incredible grace and ease for someone his age, but he announced that he was going to attend Louisville and play for Rick Pitino if he indeed attended college at all. This was before his senior season. And right before that announcement, he went into his athletic director's office and just broke down and cried, sobbed like a baby. And the pressure had gotten to him. Some family members thought he shouldn't be committing to Louisville. They thought maybe this would hurt his chances or his stock in the NBA. Some thought he should be committing to a different college or university. And he just broke down and cried, and the athletic director threw water on his face and cleaned him up and basically had to piece him back together so he can go out there before the microphones and cameras. That was really one of the few times where I saw the pressure really get to him, and he showed me his age.
The closer you got to Sebastian, the more you got to know about him and see all this pressure on him. Did you ever feel a little bit of anger or resentment towards his parents for putting so much pressure on him to basically say, you are our ticket out of here, and you cannot fail?
I felt a little uncomfortable about that whole situation, you know, and I tried to put myself in their shoes. These are people who lived in the projects for 35 years, or longer, actually. And Otis Telfair was a Vietnam vet who told me some horror stories about what he went through over there, came back and had some problems with the law, ends up being assaulted by three men on the street, and he kills one of them in revenge and ends up doing 8-9 years on a manslaughter conviction. So these people had been through a lot and really felt that this was their only way out. And they did direct that burden, put it right on Sebastian's shoulders once they realized that he did have a chance to make it. I don't know if the parents ever quite realized how much pressure that was to put on their son. They didn't verbalize it. When I asked about that, it was a subject that they didn't want to address. Again, I saw it clearly with Sebastian on a couple of occasions, and otherwise he did a great job of sort of keeping it within. And I know, I mean, the night he got drafted, he sobbed and cried in his mother's arms, and his mother was really the beacon in his life and the woman who had gone on Christmas Eve to the Salvation Army every Christmas Eve to get presents. So her 10 kids could have something on Christmas morning. And he sobbed in her arms after he was picked by the Portland Trailblazers 13th in the first round and said, Mom, you never have to count again. You never have to worry about counting again. It meant a lot to him, but again, the burdens were very real across his senior season of high school.
The tension on that draft night in 2004 must have just been unbelievable. You were there.
Yeah, it was an interesting scene, Mitch. I mean, we were actually in the Trump Tower in a suite right off of Central Park. You know, the NBA had given Sebastian, actually the commissioner of the NBA, David Stern, wanted Sebastian at the draft because the hometown Knicks did not have a first-round pick. There was no LeBron James in the draft. And David Stern realized that the best storyline was, where is this 5'11 high school kid from Brooklyn going to end up? They usually only invite the top 15 players, and they weren't sure if Sebastian was going to be picked that high. So they didn't initially invite him to the draft at Madison Square Garden, but then Stern decided, we need this kid down here for some publicity. Sebastian's agent, Andy Miller, decided that's a bad idea. If he slips in the draft, I don't need his family exploding on national TV. I don't need Sebastian crying on the back page of the next morning's New York Post. So he actually hid Sebastian away in Trump Tower. I was invited to their hideaway. The family didn't even, the Telfairs had no idea where Sebastian was. They were told to meet Sebastian at Jay-Z's new nightclub, the 4040 Club in Lower Manhattan. And basically, we sat there in this hideout and watched the draft on TV. And as the phone calls came in, most of them from the Portland Trailblazers, to Andy Miller, Sebastian's agent, saying, you know, we think we're going to take him. We think we're going to take him. The tension and the drama really builds in the hotel room. And finally, Andy Miller gets a call from John Nash, the general manager of Portland, and he says, 13 is coming up, and we're going to take Sebastian. Andy Miller turns to Sebastian and says, you're going to be a Portland Trailblazer in about 5 minutes. And Sebastian says, you know what? He points to the TV and he says, I'm not going to believe it until I hear it out of that man's mouth. And that man, of course, being David Stern.
Telfair has played over 40 games for the Trailblazers this season. He's averaging only about 4 points a game, though. Do you think he will live up to his much-hyped potential in the NBA?
I do eventually. There are a lot of people, basketball people, who thought that Sebastian would sit the bench the entire season because the point guard position is like the quarterback position in football. It's the hardest to master, to learn, and for a 5'11" teenager to come in and start running an NBA team in the fourth quarter from the point, that's just too much to ask. But Sebastian's had 23 points a couple weeks ago against Charlotte. He's had some pretty good games, and he's had other games where he looks like a completely lost high school player out there. I think that he has shown enough, and people in the Portland organization have told me this, that they do believe for 15 years he's going to be a very good point guard in this league. And they're very encouraged by what they've seen so far. And the fact that he's getting 10, 15 minutes a game, and all right, it's only 4 points, but that's four more points than some people thought he'd average this year. I think that he'll play the position the right way and be a very good NBA player for a long time.
Ian O'Connor is the author of The Jump, Sebastian Telfair and the High Stakes Business of High School Ball, published by Rodale. He joined me on the line from New York. Ian, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Mitch.
I get up, but nothing gets me down. Well, you've got it tough. I seem the toughest soul around. And I know, baby, just how you feel. You got to roll with the punches just to get to what's real.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. Special thanks this week to Vermont Public Radio Program Director Jody Evans, News Director John Van Hoosen, and to everyone at VPR. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287 toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again or sign up for our newsletter, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from New York Daily News reporter Philip Bondi, who puts this week's IOC visit into cultural context for non-New Yorkers.
Yeah, we're not real good at groveling here. It's very humiliating, you know?
Groveling. Is that an Olympic event like curling or synchronized swimming? I'm Mitch Wortley. Bill Littlefield returns next week. Thanks for listening.
You might as well jump. Well, you might as well jump. Go ahead and jump. You might as well jump. Go ahead and jump. Well, you might as well jump.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. From NPR member stations, from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from Vision to Innovative Impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org, and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.